Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.
And welcome to Contra Radio Network. I'm John Jeffers, your host, founder, and executive producer. This is the Saturday show, and for our guest, I got Ken McClellan. He is the author of the book, The Pandemic Preparedness Guide, Biohazards for Preppers. You need to have this book. Listen up to it. Patriots, you need to have this book. And I want to introduce Ken McClellan. Ken, welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. How are you?
Pretty good, buddy. Now, just so we're all clear, this is a recorded show, so don't call into the show. No one's going to be here to answer it. However, I want you to go. And Kenny, where can we get your book?
It's available through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, just about any place where books are sold.
There you go. Do not get the electronic download in case there's a power grid failure. That is an EMP. You will not be able to get this book and use it as reference because you put it in electronic form. Get the hard, real book that has actual pages, papers, numbers, all that good stuff. It's like a real book. That's important. Kenny, why did you write this book?
Well, actually, I was writing a historical novel called The Pandemic Report, and it was about the 1918 pandemic. I was fascinated by that. And while I was busy writing that, I started hearing on the news about bird flu and, you know, how bad it was over across the other side of the ocean. I started looking into it a little bit further, and I thought, man, this is pretty interesting. Then when I found out that DNA testing had shown that the 1918 pandemic was also a bird flu, then I really started taking notice. And I thought, you know, let me do some more research on this and maybe put a few pages at the end of my novel about what's coming up. And those few pages morphed into 330 pages worth of information.
It always works out that way. It never works out the way you think it's going to work out, you know. So we're talking about this. Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. What's your background, Ken?
Okay, well, actually, I'm a writer. I work for the government right now. I work at a hospital in Florida. And, but I'm not in the medical field. Let me say that. And a lot of people ask me, they said, well, what qualifies you to write a book like this? And and that troubled me at first. In fact, it kept me from completing the book for a long time because I thought, you know what, who's going to be interested in a little old me, you know, despite the research I've done and stuff. And then somebody kind of pointed out, you know, they said, well, you know, you didn't have to be on the Titanic to write about it.
Thought, that's true.
So, you know, with that in mind, I've done a lot of research on this. It's taken me 10 years. Now, granted, I wasn't working on it steady for 10 years, but it was over a 10-year period of time that I was writing this. So, whenever I get new information, I just soak it up and just kept adding it to the book.
Wow. Okay. You know, and that's an excellent answer, I think, because people are going to say, what makes Ken so qualified? Well, you can read. You have reading comprehension. You can put two and two together. I mean, the information's out there. So for all you naysayers, there you go. Let me ask you this. When you were writing the book, is there some point in time you thought, you know, there's going to be, when you're writing the book, did you start off, you start off with the avian influenza, the bird flu. When did you decide to add the Ebola? And then work your way up to terrorist attack.
Well, the Ebola itself, you know, I'd come across that in the early years because, again, you know, I started 10 years ago, and Ebola really wasn't a factor for us then. It was a problem over in Africa, but it never really left the continent, you know, so it wasn't that big of an issue. But I kind of had to add that in here when I started seeing how rapidly this was spreading. And it was what interested me was, you had the doctors and the nurses that were falling from this virus, and thinking, this thing has to be really powerful, because if you're a doctor and a nurse working in the field over in Africa and you see people dropping like flies, you're going to wear the best. I mean, you're going to take every precaution possible to make sure that you've got the proper PPE and that you've got it. You're going to cover your bases. Everything's going to be sanitary. But these people are dropping like flies. So I thought, man, this is dangerous. And then they started bringing it over here. I'm thinking, why in the world would they do that? I still don't understand that. I think, you know, my own opinion on the Ebola virus, when they started bringing it here, it would seem reasonable if you had a hospital, for example, and you had a highly pathogenic virus in your hospital, you would isolate that from the rest of the populace so that nobody else would get it. And then you'd have people that are experienced working on, you know, working with the level 4 virus, as the Ebola was. You'd have them working on it, not just, you know, Susie Q and, you know, the people that aren't experienced, let them near it. So what I would have done when they started bringing them here into this country, I would have gone ahead and had an isolated military base somewhere or a hospital that specialized in level 4 viruses and the people as well, you know, the employees. I would have those all the infected people taken to that area. That way you've contained it to one localized area. But instead, they send it all over the place. I mean, there's at least 4 or 5 different hospitals that Ebola patients were being sent to, and the nurses didn't have any idea how to work with this. That's why some of them got sick. And I don't think we ever learned the full extent of the Ebola virus, how it's impacted the United States, because I came across a report, and I believe I put that in the book, about air ambulances that were bringing Ebola patients from Africa over to the United States. And when they were interviewed, they said, well, according to our contract with the government, we're not allowed to tell you how many people we're bringing in, where we're getting them from, or where we're taking them. And my own theory on that right there, because, you know, you don't know how many they actually brought in, but my own theory on that was that they were bringing people that were sick from them and taking them to laboratories. And, again, it's just a conspiracy thing. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But I think they're probably taking them to some of these drug company laboratories, saying, look, we'll give you the best care, and this way here they can, you know, have the race to find the Ebola cure, you know. Made as good a sense as anything why they would bring them here secretly.
Right, right. Now, for you, for the listeners, you know, this is just isn't for preppers. It's also for the delegates as well. For example, Chapter 19 deals with martial law in America. Chapter 18 deals with the Posse Comitatus Act. How about Chapter 17, firearms for the common man? So this is a little bit of a compendium of, you know, I like Chapter 12, just-in-time economics. You don't know what a thin veneer our society has till you read that chapter, till it really hits home. So this is not just a book just for preppers, but for patriots as well.
I agree. I remember it was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, started seeing that in the stores, the local supermarkets, where there was a limit on how much rice you could buy. And it's like, Wow, where would they have that? And then I found out there was some storm or something over in the Middle East, you know, where we got a lot of the rice from, and that just raised the prices up. And it's like people are going in and buying this stuff, and they're only limit or they're rationed to so many pounds, 10 pounds or whatever it was. And, right. You know, this kind of tied in with the just-in-time economics. If something were to happen, a bird flu or a Ebola pandemic, or even just the scare of it, I mean, if it's just started up in one region of the country, people are going to start flocking. They're going to flock to their stores, and they're going to start buying stuff. And it's like the stores just don't have enough stock on hand to, you know, to let everybody buy a case of soup, for example. All right. So at some point, they will have to limit the, you know, I'm sure that if something starts, you're going to see signs at the grocery stores saying limit, you know, 2 cans per customer. All right. And this is where the just-in-time economics comes in, because the stores can't, they don't physically have the warehouses to store, you know, X amount of food or whatever. So the typical procedure is you go there, and when you're buying a can of soup at Publix or wherever, your supermarket, the computer is reading that barcode. It sends a signal out to the warehouse somewhere in Poughkeepsie or wherever, and they say, hey, we need some soup. So the computers do all the organizing and the ordering, and so this way here the stores have, they can make the most of the space that they have, you know, rather than having cases and cases of soup or spaghetti. I mean, you think about it, they really couldn't stockpile that much. But as long as you got a centralized warehouse, that's fine. But at any given time, there's no more than 3 days worth of food in a grocery store. And if a crisis happens, it's going to go faster than 3 days, obviously. And that's when you're going to find out what Rasmi is all about. And then people are going to say, wait a minute, what about those preppers? They had the right idea.
Yes. That. Well, the idea of my radio show is to put the information out there. Because I'll tell you, if I could get one person in my neighborhood to start prepping, that's one less person that might be knocking on my door, you know. And I think this, you know what, there's a reason it took so long for us to hook up and do this interview. Because, you know, for you listeners out there, Kay and I have been talking since, what, November? October?
Yeah,
it's been a while. And now we finally hooked up. I finally found some mechanism for us to hook up so I can record this interview, and I'm going to keep this thing. However, if you listened to the show last night, listeners, which would have been the Wednesday night show, we talked about it. There is a measles outbreak in the United States because down in, what was it? Is it New Orleans? Measles outbreak in Memphis that's coming from the refugees. And there's also up in Minnesota, there's an outbreak of tuberculosis because of the refugees, the Syrian refugees coming in. So this book is quite timely. And, you know, I'm sure if Kenny had time, he would have probably added another couple chapters based on that alone. But one of the things, looking through the book, you have names of politicians who have, support weapons collection and disarmament. Not that it's very difficult to figure out, but we got names. Names are good. We have, one thing you talked about, which I thought was interesting, was the Y2K. I remember having to work that night because they were absolutely, betting the farm that if this happened, it was going to be bad. And so, I had to tell my wife, my first wife, I said, if things go sideways on this, they got shelter down at the sheriff's office. All you got to do is drive down there with the kids, and they'll take care of everything. They made that. I mean, that's how serious they took it. And granted, nothing happened. At least nothing. Let's put it this way. Nothing happened that I know about. But I thought it was interesting that you put it in there. And chapter 10, I like chapter 10, where you're talking about the case fatality ratios and what the CDC has projected. That's some scary stuff. I mean.
And Ebola was worse.
I followed the Ebola outbreak in West Africa back in June of 2014? Yeah, June of 2014. And I said, I'm looking and I'm reading stuff. I said, the way things are going there, this Ebola could potentially reach the United States in about 2 weeks. What I didn't know is that they were actually going to fly people in with the Ebola virus. It's like, well, that's kind of not what I wanted to work out, but it was within 2 weeks. But I'm thinking, and now hearing you, and what you're saying, that, yeah, guess what? They could have very well flown in a lot more and taken them to the pharmaceutical labs. Now, is that good or bad? I think it's good. I wouldn't want to be the guinea pig, but I think, on the whole, if it's us being threatened with the Ebola, it would be nice to say, we got something for it now. But I think this is just – and it's incredible what the government will do. Will say, do, and not do to further its own agenda. So.
Well, touching back on that, the air ambulance service, in case I didn't make it clear to the listeners, the air ambulance service were hired by the United States government to bring those people in. So, and like you said, it could have been nothing nefarious about it. It may have had completely good intentions. It's like, hey, we're going to bring these people in. We don't want panic. But, or it could have been a reward system. It's like, hey, you've donated a lot to our campaign. You're going to help us out. This is a win-win for everybody. And I don't know whether they made any headway toward a cure. And, again, I'm only speculating about them going to pharmaceutical labs, but it makes sense. Why would the government bring them in otherwise? Now, granted, the United States government has a a patent on Ebola, on one strain of the Ebola virus, just in case your readers or the listeners aren't aware of that. But the strain that we have a patent on, or the United States government has a patent on, is not the one that was causing the problems over in Africa, or the one that was brought here. Makes you wonder why we'd have a patent on an Ebola virus, though.
It is a good question. That's a really good question. And now, the MERS virus. You know, for a while we heard about the MERS virus. It's kind of like disappeared off of the front page. Mm-hmm. What's going on with that?
I haven't seen anything. You know, I haven't been looking, to be honest with you. But it was in the news, I think, at the end of last year. But anyway, but you know, to give some background on the MERS virus, it was a Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome is what it was called. And it started in Egypt, I believe, and it just basically stayed in the Middle East. You know, I forget how many 9 or 10 countries that it affected. But what I found interesting was that, you know, they could never find the source for it. And they said it was probably camels or tomb bats, you know, bats that came out of the tombs of the pharaohs. You know, that's the origin of these bats that started the MERS virus. But there was one person that I named in the book, and again, I probably should have that in front of me, but you know, it was somebody that researches this, and she said that it cannot be ruled out that this was intentionally developed. You know, she didn't come right out and say it, but she alluded to the idea that it could have been a terrorist act that created this virus, and this shouldn't surprise anybody because. Bird flu viruses. Well, even the Ebola, I guess. There have been certain terrorist factions over in the Middle East that have been experimenting, trying to make some kind of a. They've been trying to weaponize viruses, and their plan was to get some people infected, send them over here or wherever they've got passports to go to, and you know they're going to show up at the airport, they're going to look healthy because you know they've been infected, but it hasn't started to show the symptoms yet. So they get into a host country. Meanwhile, every place that they're going to that they're sneezing on and, you know, and stuff, they're spreading that virus. When they start showing the symptoms, God only knows how many people they've come into contact with who may now be carriers themselves. So as far as I know, they haven't been successful yet, but they're looking to do it.
Just the fact they're trying to do it? Yeah. Here, now, if you could, I want you to tell the preppers and the patriots, this is going to be of interest. So listen up, listeners. We're going to talk about the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. What is that, Ken?
Okay. You would catch me without my notes. okay. Oh, man, you got me off.
I'll tell you what. Go find your notes. It's not a problem. We've got nothing but time. This is important. I'm going to say it again for the listeners. It's the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. I have never even heard of this, which is kind of frightening in my world because when I see something like this, I'm thinking, what is the government up to? This doesn't even sound good. So,
okay, it's called the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and what it is each state was mandated by the federal government to have a plan ready for the relocation and containment of large numbers of people. And whether they're facilities or POW camps, FEMA camps, whatever you want to call them, every state was required to have a plan like this, all right? So let's say Ohio, all right? Let's say Ohio, they've got an outbreak in the eastern part of the state. They've got to relocate people to the other side of the state or somewhere within their state, or probably, I guess they could take them from FEMA region to FEMA region. But with each one of these areas, this plan that they had to have, they were supposed to have the facilities where they could feed them, clothe them, medical attention, all of that. And I just don't see that the states have been doing this. I mean, if they were, it's like, how can we not hear about it? Because everybody seems so unprepared when there's a hurricane or something like that. Hey, we hear about, hey, what about this emergency state? You know, it's like, or the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. Nobody ever talks about it, but it's a real thing. And there was another thing that tied into that. There was federal contracts that were given out, I can't remember the date, 2014, I believe, 2014 or beginning of 2015. There were contracts issued for I mean, the bid went out, rather, and the contracts have been issued. But the bid went out for a company or organization to relocate large numbers of the population, you know, within short notice. All right, now that you're talking buses and buses, well, they bid the contract, and so you're thinking, all right, where are they going to relocate them to? Well, there was another contract issued where KBR, I believe, got the bid, where they would go ahead and build up temporary containment facilities. There were fenced-in facilities that they had to be constructed within 36 hours, where they could have 1,000 people. It was either going to be 300 people or 1,000 people, depending on the outbreak. But, you know, the contract was for 300 or 1,000-person containment facilities. And I'm guessing that's where they would be bused to if there was a bird flu outbreak or Ebola or what have you, or some new virus. Or you know, I guess it could really be just about any emergency that came up.
For the listeners, what is KBR?
It's Halliburton, formerly Halliburton. It's Keller Brown and Root. They're a big contractor. When I was in the Boilermakers, I remember seeing them a lot. They're a major contractor and a major government contractor. And KBR, you know, a lot of people have heard about them and Halliburton being associated with former Vice President. Maybe just escaped me. Bush's vice president. Anyway, there's a lot of talk about that. But anyway, the KBR, like I said, they're a major government contractor, and they seem to get a lot of contracts here and abroad for the government.
Huh. So, okay. All right. Now I see you've got a list by state, starting on page 192. A list by state of FEMA camps that you've compiled that you'll be able to find. I think it's very interesting. If you are a patriot or a prepper, you need to know where these camps are going to be located. You need to know a lot of stuff. And this book is just chock full of information. I would strongly suggest you get this book for your survival library. You're going to need it. Because if you can figure out, and Ken's done the work for you. If you can figure out what phase the government is in, you can figure out what their next move is going to be. If need be, avoid that. And that's, as they used to say, knowing is half the battle. So
G.I. Joe.
Knowing is half the battle. Violence is the other half.
Yeah, regarding those FEMA camps. You know, to be honest with the listeners, I didn't compile the list. I found it in more than one place, so it's like, okay, I wrote to the one place where I put down as the source where people can go look at it for themselves. So, I've listed that source so they can go look for themselves, and I wrote to that source and asked them if I could use this. I never wrote back, and I thought, you know what, it's out there on the public domain, so I just went ahead and pasted and copied that. As far as the FEMA camps, again, I don't want to say plausible deniability, but I said, I can't confirm or deny that this base is here or this base is there. What I can say is there's so much information out there about these camps that there's something there. And, we know we got Chrome Detention Facility here in Florida. And when I was working on a Navy base out in California, I noticed there was a fenced-in area. Now, this isn't even on the list, and it may not be a camp. But I noticed that there was a fenced-in area on the base that I was working at, and it was, it must have been 10 to 15 acres worth of fenced-in area where they had guard towers.
Mm-hmm.
What it was used for or what it was intended for, because nobody was there. I mean, nobody was in that area, in the fenced-in area, and there were no guards in the towers. But I wondered back then, I thought, I wonder if that's related to this FEMA camp stuff or if this is a throwback from World War II. I don't know, but in any case, so I can't tell you that there's places like that out there.
What is a Q station?
A Q station. You lost me.
Page 71, we've got the it's talks about the CDC through its Global Migration and Quarantine Division. It says it lists the following 19 airports and one land crossing as official CDC quarantine stations. And it says the United States International Airport Quarantine Stations, also known as Q stations. Why?
Okay,
what is the purpose of a Q station?
Well, this has all been, but most of them have been done away with this act by Barack Obama not long ago. But what it was they realized when we had the bird flu problem several years back, you know, 8 years, 10 years ago, when the bird flu was acting up over in Thailand and Indonesia and mm-hmm. places that had nothing to do with us, the government that said, you know what, we need to have set facilities. If somebody's sick, they're going to go to these quarantine stations, specific hospital or airports, where they would be disembarking passengers or debarking passengers. They would be scanned for heat signatures, and that was their plan. Was they're going to, you know, see if people have a fever, and then they're going to say, all right, you're sick, and we need to have you be tested to see if you have the bird flu virus. So they set up all these different, these major hubs, you know, in the airports or whatever, and there were supposed to be quarantine stations. And then, you know, I think there was one land station. But, again, Barack Obama has done away with that, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, that sounds like they're going towards – it sounds like they're going right towards the open borders type thing. That's what it sounds like.
Well, you know what, you're right on the money, because – it seems like all the things that would make sense to you and I, the government under this leadership at least, and I don't want to put it off all, you know, put it all off on him, though I would like to. but
we all
it learn. Seems like the government doesn't seem to always act in our best interest.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? No. Now you've done your thing. We got chapter 22 I find interesting too, and that's the OTC meds, fakes, and home remedies. Are there really any home remedies for these viruses?
Well, I don't know about if they're actual remedies or if they just will alleviate the symptoms. But, you know, I did a lot of searching on that right there. And trust me, there's a whole lot more out there. But I figure, you know what, if the crap ever hits the fan, people are going to want something. And I can guarantee you, you're not going to find it down at your local pharmacy, which is going to be raided and depleted of everything they got. Unlike that TV show Containment that's on TV right now that I kind of like, unlike that right there, everything's going to be gone in, you know, in short order. The hospitals are going to be raided, or, well, like the hospital I was, the new hospital that we built in my area, mm-hmm. the Veterans Hospital, they put a fence all around it, and I thought, well, that's peculiar. And now the other hospital, they're putting a fence around that too. For what reason?
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out.
Absolutely right.
Now, preventive measures. What kind of preventive measures should preppers and patriots take should there be an epidemic or a pandemic or even a biological attack here in the United States? What kind of preventive measures can the average prepper, average patriot take to protect himself?
Okay, well, something that they practiced back in 1918 is something that the government's going to draw on even, you know, in the event of such an event, you know, that should happen today. It's called social distancing. And essentially what that was, you know, if you and I saw each other on the street, we would keep a distance of at least 4 feet between us, because when you're talking, your spittle is going out there. It's invisible. You know, and the lighter particles that are containing the virus, if you're sick, they're going to be airborne, so you want to keep at least a 4 foot distance between anybody. And that would come, you know, be the same thing as if your neighbor, if you think, well, my neighborhood's safe. Well, hey, how do you know your neighbor hasn't been out shopping somewhere or out scouting the area and he comes across something? So social distancing it's a good idea, and that's one thing that we can take in the event that something happens. Before it happens, there are certain supplies that I would encourage people to get, and, you know, I hate to sound like a panic, you know, like I'm panicking, but people, if you don't get the rubber gloves, for example, nitrile gloves, if you don't get those right there and you don't get masks, you're not going to get them, you know, if something starts. I guarantee you, if something starts, and I think I touched on this in the book, if something were to start in China, let's say, when they start using up all their supplies, they're going to start buying stuff from the United States, you know, from our suppliers.
Our inventories, yeah.
Exactly. They're going to deplete our inventories, and while we might think, well, they're going to withhold some for us, I'm sure they will for the first responders. But otherwise, you know, they're going for the dollar, because this whole world seems to revolve around the dollar right now. So if somebody says, hey, you know, China says, hey, you know what, we need some more masks, 3M or whoever, you know, if they make them, anything that's made in the United States, gloves, masks, the bunny suits, you know, any PPE that's related, they're gonna give it to China, because if they withheld it, we're gonna look bad to the rest of the world, you know, and they're gonna say, well, you know what, we're gonna look bad, so we're gonna sell them to them, and of course they're gonna have inflated prices. But what it comes down to is John Q. Citizen isn't gonna be able to find them on his shelf, and you're not gonna be able to order them. So get them out. And I've got one more thing to add as far as the masks go. Ideally, the face mask, you know, the rubber face mask with the spin-on filters, that would be the best thing, you know. And if I would like to say a full face would be best, but, you know, if you've ever worn a full face, man, they fog up really quick. And if you're all fogged up, you can't see what you're doing. That's not a good thing, especially if you've got to, you know, be on a run. But like I said, that would be the ideal thing. But you got to make sure that the spin-on filters are made for viruses. You know, they can't be something for dust particles. And they'll say right on there that they usually make filters for different applications, you know, whether it's solvents or smells, dust, particulates, whatever. They'll tell that to you. But that would be the ideal thing. But you've got to make sure that you buy the right size for the faces you want to protect. And then if you can't get those, or if it's economically not feasible for you to do that, because the mask might be affordable, but when you start buying those filters, how many are you going to have on hand, you know? But granted, you know, that you can reuse that. You put that down and you can pick it back up and start wearing it. Whereas the portable or the disposable masks, that right there, you know, they generally don't want you to use those for more than, you know, wearing one time, which I would agree with that. But, you know, hey, I've been out there in the field having to use these when I go inside a boiler or something, and, you know, an environment that's not real friendly with a lot of particulates in the air. And I've reused it. You know, I take it off to have a cigarette back when I smoked. But as far as the masks go, you want at least an N95 mask. You know, N95, that's what the CDC and the NIOSH, you know, they've all said that right there would be adequate for any kind of a virus. So I would recommend that you get, you know, if you're going to buy an N95 mask, you know, the disposable ones like 3M or AO Safety, there's a lot of different manufacturers out there. But make sure that you try them on the faces that you want to protect. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I bought several for myself and for my wife, but she's 100 pounds, you know, so try the mask on her. It's like there is no way in God's green earth that mask would save her if, you know, something happened. Right. So I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and buy some smalls, you know. And I got samples from different manufacturers, and the smalls just didn't fit. They were too big for her face. Now, this was several years ago, so maybe some of them have gotten wise to that and started making smaller ones. But what I found is an alternative. I believe I got it from AO Safety, and it's called the duckbill mask. Basically, it's a flat mask, which is nice. I mean, you could fit it in your wallet or in several of them in your glove box. But it's just a flat mask, and then, you know, you got to put it on, and it's still N95 rating. You know, so it's still good in that respect. You just got to make sure you have a good seal. But with that, you know, with that option, having that duckbill mask, I was able to fit it onto her face because, like I said, none of the preformed masks that you generally see in photographs and stuff, none of those would work on her face, which means there's no way that they would work for a child's face either. So just consider that, you know, and make sure that you, you know, anybody that gets these masks, make sure that if you ever have to use them, you've got to be shaven. You know, for 20-some years when I worked at the Space Center, I had every year, you know, routinely we had to try on all these different masks, from paper masks to the half-face, full-face, emergency, you know, I can't remember what that one kind is called. But trying on all these masks, you know, they've stressed repeatedly that viruses and particulates can get in even past the hairs that are on your face. That mask will hold it out that much that stuff like, you know, the smaller stuff will go through that. So you've got to have a clean-shaven face.
Good point. I've got listeners all over the world. What about other countries? Now, how about Canada, for example? Is Canada prepared along the lines that the United States is?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't even know how prepared we are now as a nation. I know that we were, when the bird flu was active overseas, there was a lot of activity over here, you know, including they would have tabletop exercises where they would do a simulation of, okay, if this happened, you know, what are we going to do about it and what's our response? Do we have enough equipment? Do we have enough trained manpower? You know, that kind of thing. So with not knowing what we have, I would say that Canada, they're probably in the same boat. You know, the big problem that I see with Canada right now is, well, you know, of course, we're about to enter that ourselves. They're bringing so many immigrants in through that country that are coming from, let's say, virus-heavy countries. So whatever happens might start in that country.
Oh,
and again, you know, I don't want to just push it off all off onto Canada, because on our southern border, we've got people coming across that border that they found with Ebola. They found from a countries that where Ebola is running rampant. You know, not now, but back when Ebola was a thing back in 2014.
Yeah.
But you know, we've got people coming from the Middle East that they were coming here because they were afraid of Ebola over there, and they knew that if they got it, they could come to the United States and they get free health care. So, but as far as how prepared Canada is, to be honest with you, I think that if there's an outbreak in Canada, it's going to be the United States within weeks or within days, and vice versa.
Well, let me ask you this then.
Okay.
Europe has been flooded with the Syrian quote unquote refugees. Have you heard or picked up on anything of these communicable viruses having an outbreak in Europe?
I don't know about an outbreak, but I think it was a blog from a nurse over in Germany, and she said that as soon as she's able, she was from Sweden originally, she went to Germany to help out with the refugees, you know, because, you know, she saw that there was a lot of illnesses and stuff. And she was scared to death. She said, you know, she gave a timeline. You know, she's heading back home. She said, this is crazy. What's happening over there? She said, these people are coming there that have never had any kind of health care. They've got diseases that the rest of the world has already overcome, and now they're bringing it, to the children. You know, and it's a bad thing. And these aren't, you know, it's not Ebola or anything like that, but if they're bringing tuberculosis, for example, if they're bringing tuberculosis over, and they're not, you know, the local population isn't inoculating for that anymore, just like we don't. You know, we don't give TB shots like we did when I was growing up. But, it could start out once it starts. All the kids that have not gotten the shots that we got when we were younger, they're going to be susceptible to catching it. So, like I said, this nurse, she was scared to death. She said, I'm going home as soon as I can, and I'll never come back. But again, that's there. Yeah. Well, it's not going to get any better. You know, but you know, on that same tone, you remember there were Barack Obama had asked for 84,000, I think, refugees, and then somebody bumped that number up to 100,000. Well, the last count, and Paul Ryan signed it in, was 300,000 refugees, supposed refugees, because a lot of them are coming from Muslim countries where they aren't refugees. You know, there was no need for them to leave, but 300,000 of them coming here in the first year. And they said that they plan on doing the same thing the year after that. So with that in mind, you're talking a third of a million people. And I've seen the photographs of them, and I see very little women and children who you would expect if there were refugees. You know, they're the most at risk. Those, you know, the Christians. But the Christians, as I understand it, you know, they threw a lot of those overboard when they were coming over on boats, you know, going from the Middle East over into Europe where they were trying to flee. They were throwing the Christians overboard, so what I see in the photographs is a lot of soldier-aged men. I'm sure they're not all terrorists, but how many do you need?
Yeah. Well, I've posted before on the Contra Rio Network Facebook page pictures of – I've got four of them. Four pictures, four different men taken in Syria during the combat, and the same four men showing up in Europe. Really? How does this happen? So I don't disagree with you on your assessment. And I agree with you 100% that the third world has, you know, mankind was on the verge of eliminating the measles threat. But some third world countries decided they can't afford it, they're not going to do it, whatever. And like I said, 2 days ago, that story popped up out of Memphis. Measles outbreak in Memphis coming from one of the mosques. They zeroed in on it. You know, I don't even know. Do they even give measles inoculations anymore to the children here in the United States?
No, but there was a big push last year when the measles outbreak happened in California. There was a lot of a lot of parents and a lot of civic organizations to start the measles inoculation program. And a lot of parents were reluctant to that. You know, they said, well, wait a minute. My child's doing fine without it. If your child gets inoculated, what do you have to fear from my child? You know, if the inoculations work. But anyway, you know, to me, I guess I don't want to make a stand on that right there. But what I will say is that, I did some research on it, and not one person had died in the past, I think since 2004 when the records that I went back to, not one person had died from measles. So if they're pushing to make mandatory vaccinations for measles where nobody has died, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but right. Nobody has died from that. If you're going to make the argument that we need to vaccinate these kids for measles, what about influenza? I mean, there's on a regular year without any epidemic or pandemic, on a regular year, they say 36,000 people die from complications due to influenza in the United States alone. So if you're going to make the argument to force inoculate children for measles that doesn't kill anybody, how much of a leap do you have to make to say, hey, you know what, let's force vaccinate for flu, you know, that does kill people, you know, 36,000 a year on any given year.
Right.
So, and, you know, I just hate to think that way because, you know, I think it's a personal choice. I haven't had the flu shot in I can't even tell you how long, and I'm okay with that. You know, if the worst happens and don't make it, you know, hey, that's God's will. I'll live with that.
Mm-hmm. All right. But what else can we talk about?
Well, let me catch what we're thinking on the vaccinations. With the vaccinations, you know, you can't have a allergic reactions to those. I had an allergic reaction to a tetanus diphtheria shot, and it caused me – I've got a disease right now that I've got to take medicine for every day. It's an autoimmune disorder. It's like, man, it's painful as all get out. But, again, we're taking a vaccine that, you know, that worked fine on everybody else. You know, of course, it was a mess up by the doctors, but I guess the government's allowed to do that, and you got to learn to live with it. But people can have adverse reaction to vaccines, and I touch on that in the book as well. That you know, so you can't take vaccines lightly. It's not like going and getting having your teeth checked or something like that, because you can have an adverse reaction. And one of the symptoms that people have, or one of the diseases that people have gotten from flu shots, was called Guillain-Barré. And Guillain-Barré, that's what I thought I had when I first came down with this disease. It was so similar. But Guillain-Barré, it's kind of like a mild form of multiple sclerosis. It's got a lot of the characteristics, but fortunately, in most people, it's not permanent. My daughter had it. She got that years ago when she was pregnant, and I don't know what she got it from. She had her vaccine, you know, back then or what. But anyway, she had that, and she still struggles with that to this day. And one more note on that before we change topics. Back in 1975, I believe it was, we had a big scare about the swine flu. A lot of people the older people will remember that. We had the swine flu, and people in the epidemiological community were concerned that this is a flare-up of the 1918 virus come back to haunt us. They remember what happened in 1918, where as many as from 50 million to 100 million people died in a year and a half's time. So they were concerned about that. So they said, well, you know what? We need to mass inoculate the people of the United States. So, you know, what happened was one guy in Fort Dix, New Jersey, caught the swine flu, and I think he's the only one that ever died from it. But 9 or 10 people died from the vaccination. So when you start talking, you know, the government realized that, hey, wait a minute, this inoculation is killing more people than the swine flu is. Let's stop it. So they stopped it, you know, otherwise the whole population would have been inoculated for no reason.
And, of course, to do the inoculation for the vaccine to work, you have to introduce the dead virus into a living host, correct?
Correct. It used to be a live virus that they put into people, but right now the only live viruses I believe they use is I can't remember the name of it, but there's a spray I believe that they spray into the nose, and that's got a light live virus. In other words, it's not full strength or whatever. But otherwise, you know, now typically we're using viruses. You know, people say, well, I don't want to get the shot because, you know, I'll get the flu. You know, and that's not true anymore.
Okay, now, that reminds me. I was looking at your book, and for the listeners, I want you to understand something. On the back is a endorsement by Dr. Ryan Chamberlain, and I'm only going to read to you the first paragraph, so you understand that what Ken has put together here is something that my guess that people in the medical community could not come out publicly and say. But this is what it is. This is from Dr. Ryan Chamberlain. He says, as a professor at medical school and author of three books, medical books, I found the medical information presented in this work to be remarkably accurate. And that's quite a feat for someone who hasn't been indoctrinated into the rigid confines of medicine. But that shouldn't have surprised me because the author writes very, very well. Now, look, this is a doctor who's kind of come – or a professor who's come out and, put his reputation on the line for Ken. But if he says this information that's in this book is remarkably accurate, don't you think you should have the same book in your library? I do. No.
Yeah, I was really grateful when I saw that. That was my first review, actually. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, man, this is awesome. You know, I couldn't have asked for a better review, you know, because he's not just a doctor or an author, but he's a professor that teaches medicine. I would suggest that you have him on your show. I'm telling you, this guy's just a whirlwind of knowledge. I've gotten to know him a little bit since he wrote that review, and just grateful to him for that. But anyway, like I said, he's a good resource. And he has written prepper books as well. So, it's nice to have that tie-in. But, yeah, I really appreciated the kind words that he had to say. That's very nice.
Ken.
Yes, sir.
What else do you want to tell the listeners?
Well, I was able, my last update on the book with the publisher when they let me do a final edit, I said, I would like to add something in here about what's going on in the country at this moment. Because, I think a lot of people just didn't pay attention. They looked at the egg prices and they thought, oh, well, egg prices are going up. Big deal. It just went up a handful of pennies. But I don't think a lot of people realize that last year we were hit with three different strains of bird flu that directly attacked our food supply. It says it's the worst attack on our food supply in the history of the United States. And we ended up killing up to 50 million birds, and it may have been more than that, but 50 million or approximately 50 million is the figures that they were giving out. That's chickens and turkeys. Now, you think about how many eggs that we lost, too. I never even saw a number for that right there, but I imagine it's phenomenal.
It has to be huge.
Oh, absolutely. And it just goes to show that this could happen at any time. It doesn't have to be a terrorist attack that gets us, because those right there – the viruses that came in here, they landed in farms. This is what the experts say. They said, well, we don't know exactly how this started. They said, but we assume that it was migratory birds that came in during the normal migration patterns. Twice a year we got, the south and the north, the birds flying back and forth, right? And you get birds from other countries or, around the world, really, that swing through here, and they'll see a pond, and they'll stop in, and that's how normally we would have a bird flu problem. You get some bird flying in from Canada, and he's passing through, and he just sees a pond. He says, hey, I'm going to sit down there and, take a swim, get whatever, all right? Well, he drops feces. Other birds get it. They walk through it, and then now they've got it. Cats go ahead and eat the bird. They've got it. It'll spread that way. But this particular case that started, in 2015, that was from migratory birds. They said, well, that's what we believe it happened. But we don't understand how they could have gotten into the farms, inside the barns where these, because these are commercially grown birds.
Right.
They're all, so they spend their whole life inside of a barn, or a big building. They don't understand how this migratory birds could have gotten the disease in there and to get it to so many places, because it hit many states. I think 22 states came down with the bird flu. And again, with three different strains.
Yeah. I remember this. Because actually, the United States had to import eggs from the Netherlands to try to keep up on the supply that we needed. And you're absolutely correct. They don't know how. And I'm not sure I'm buying the migratory bird theory. Because I know that, when it comes to the commercial birds, they're kept in, you know, in roofed, enclosed areas, unlike in Europe where they're kept outside. They're kept inside here in the United States. I'm, you know, this is me. It's me and going off on my paranoia. Maybe not. And that is, who's to say it wasn't introduced intentionally?
I wouldn't even try to refute that supposition, because it's possible. I mean, how did it get inside the barns? And not just one barn, but barns all
right.
over the place. Well, it could have been a coordinated attack. Who knows? But another thing that was troubling about that right there was when you look at the photographs of the people that were going inside the barns. Now, there's a procedure that's involved with this right here, especially when there's any kind of a virus. All right? So here you've got a farm that's got the virus on it. All right? They're having to call all these birds. Well, you've got workers that are just walking in there like it's, you know, like they're walking into Walmart. Now, granted, they got their boots and, you know, their work equipment on, but they're not wearing PPE. They're not wearing any kind of a mask or anything like that. And some of the people from the, I think it was the FDA, reported, they said, well, they're not following procedures as far as washing their boots, you know, cleaning their boots before they
right.
go in and when they come out. And so they're not following those protocols. With that in mind, how long would it take if one of these guys had it on their boots? They take it home, and, you know, they set their boots down there. The dog comes and licks on that.
Oh.
Well, these viruses can spread, you know, to the animal populations. That's not exclusive to mankind.
Correct.
You know, speaking of the viruses, you know, I hope I'm not going off on a tangent here. Something that, you know, that people should understand about viruses, all right? Everybody has different viruses inside of them. You've got different viruses than I've got. Everybody, because the vaccines that you've had, you've got a strain of this virus, that virus, and, you know, however many viruses. You overcome them, so now you've got immunities to those, whereas I might not. You know, you've got immunity to maybe 100 of them, and I've got immunity to 40 of them. You know, so with that in mind, when the medical community, the FDA, actually gets together and they say, all right, let's make a vaccine for next year for the flu vaccine, well, they just make it up. They say, all right, this is what we – we're starting to see a trend where this strain of virus, you know, influenza viruses, is predominant. So we'll make a concoction mixing viruses from different years, including the one that they think is going to be the predominant strain. And that's how they come up with the flu vaccine. So when you get inoculated with a flu vaccine, it's hit or miss whether you're going to be susceptible to the virus, because sometimes they get it wrong.
That's right.
Anyway.
That's absolutely correct. By the time they create the vaccine, to the time the virus actually hits the United States, for example, that virus can have mutated once, twice, three times, several times. And so whatever vaccine they came up with is absolutely useless.
Correct. And that's something else I wanted to talk about was the mutation. Because you've got different viruses in you than I've got in me, let's say we're both working on a farm, the pig over there, he sneezes. Well, that pig can carry bird flu viruses and human viruses, as well as swine flu virus.
Oh.
Well, you start getting this mixing and matching of viruses. It's just a matter, same with the birds, it's kind of like a combination lock. Let me sidestep just a second. When I worked at the Space Center, I worked with this one guy. He used to lean back in the chair up against the lockers, and he just reached behind him, and he turned a combination lock on the locker that he was leaning on. All right, not looking at the numbers or anything, just goofing off while we're talking. Right, sooner or later, if he did that often enough, sooner or later that lock would open. Well, it's the same way with the virus. When that virus is getting, you know, virus from a bird or somebody sneezes on you at the airport, whatever, you know, because you've got different viruses in you, that virus gets in your system. Maybe it doesn't affect you, but now it's mixing and mingling with the viruses that you have inside of you, and the antiviruses, all right? So you could be walking around with that right there and be just happy-go-lucky and not show any symptoms, but you could be a carrier. My system isn't the same as yours, so I get it. You know, same with the two guys working on the farm. You know, they're working around this pig, and, you know, and the chickens are passing flu viruses to the pig, and the pig's catching yours. You know, it's like that combination lock. Sooner or later, the right combination of viruses are going to make the species leap into mankind, and we'll have a 1918 pandemic all over again. And that's a big concern I have. And there's really nothing we can do to stop stuff like that from happening. All we can do is get prepared. Hope I didn't stray too far.
You know, Ken, you've just ruined a perfectly good day for me today.
Stay healthy, my friend.
It's going to be in the 70s for a while. The sun's out. And here's Ken saying, guess what? It's just a matter of Mother Nature being the devious animal that she is, flipping around the combinations, and presto, here we go, have at it. Yeah, and you're right. There is nothing you can do to stop that because you got to have the virus out there active before you can come up with the vaccine. Hopefully
correct.
You're not going to be the victim of it. That's about the way I see it, the way I'm thinking
okay.
about it. I think that's it.
And here's an interesting thing about the vaccines. When something happens, and it's going to happen, all the virologists out there, you know, the people that specialize in viruses, all of them say that sooner or later we are going to get hit by a pandemic. When that happens, the government, I think George W. Bush signed it, you know, and again, I can understand why, I can see the reasoning behind it, but he signed a thing that gave immunity to vaccine manufacturers in the event of a pandemic. And the reason for that is because the manufacturers are saying, well, wait a minute. We don't want to be drawn into court and lawsuits, you know, over people that die from our vaccine if we're forced to hastily come up with a vaccine.
That's
so
a good point.
Said, right. So I can understand their reasoning, and I can understand President Bush, you know, or any president signing something like that because, like, we don't want them to just raise their hand and say, nope, we're not going to make anything. So what he did was give them immunity, you know, because when you get a vaccine right now, it goes through rigorous testing before, you know, before they – try it out on people. Well, they're not going to have time to do that if there's a pandemic. So the viruses, you could turn into Dr. You know, it could be Dr. Frankenstein's formula for all we know.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's true.
You know, hopefully it'll work, but, you know,
hopefully it'll work. Maybe it won't. I don't know.
mm-hmm.
And you're right.
And if it ever comes down to a situation like that right there, I'm sure there's laws on the books where they'll be able to force inoculate people, and if they don't, that, you know, that's fine, because, you know, I'm not going to be anxious to take an antivirus. You know, honest to goodness, I don't want an inoculation that's been hastily made by some drug manufacturer that's trying to make money off this and knows that he's got immunity. You know, so with that in mind, that's where the social distancing comes in, and if you're out in the country, God bless you. You know, hopefully you have friends with you that. You know, friends or family members that can help you hold on to what you have, because when a pandemic starts, it's not going to be like 1918, which, you know, again, I touch on that in the book. And in 1918, people have different moral character than we have today. I mean,
well, yeah.
When, you know, the Y2K thing that you mentioned a while ago, it was during Y2K time that I was working with the guy at the Space Center, and he told me, he said, Ken, there are guys that will kill you for your sneakers. What do you think they'll do when they get hungry? It's like, wow, I never considered that until he said that. And that made me turn into prepper mode on the Y2K. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you're one of them crazy people, you know. I thought, well, that's fine, but it's kind of like house insurance. I buy house insurance. I hope I'll never need it. I buy life insurance, car insurance, flood insurance. I've got all this insurance on me that I hope I'll never need. And what I'm doing is I'm betting the insurance company I'm going to die. And they're saying, oh, no, we're betting that you're not going to. Well, it's kind of the same thing, you know, with prepping. When you buy food and supplies, you're buying something for an event that you hope we'll never have to use for. But
right.
If the worst case happens, you've got the stuff because you won't be able to get it when the doo-doo hits the fan. And then another perspective, as far as your food goes, unlike house insurance or car insurance, you can eat that food if times get tough. You know, even if a pandemic doesn't happen, you get laid off or somebody in your family gets ill or whatever, you know. You've got food to eat, so it's buying tomorrow's groceries at today's prices is another way to look at it.
I like that. That's good. That's good. So,
you know,
right, buddy.
On the store issue, you know, on stocking up on food,
mm-hmm.
People can go to the store right now. You can go to your local Publix or Walmart or Winn-Dixie or wherever, and you can. Most of them, I've heard of a couple that wouldn't, but most of them, you can go there and say, hey, I want a case of Campbell's chicken noodle soup. By the way, chicken noodle soup, there's something in that the scientists say is perfect for influenza, for helping you get over it quickly. Maybe it's the salt in there or the heat, you know, they're not sure, but But so chicken soup is actually a good, a viable option for helping you with the flu. But anyway, you can go to your store and you can tell them, hey, I want a case of soup. You know, you get a 24-pack or a 48-pack. They're already shrink-wrapped and everything, so that makes it nice for storage and for if you had to move real quickly, you know, to relocate to a different area. But you can go in there and order that. I don't like to pull them right off the shelf because I don't want 24 cans of soup rolling around. I want them all contained in that shrink wrap. But you can go in there and you wait till they're on sale, and they'll usually honor that sale price, even though the goods might not, you know, the soup might not come for another couple days or a week. They'll call you when the soup comes in. You go and pick up your case. You can do that right now all day long, and they're not going to say a word to you. They're happy for the business. But as soon as something starts, all that's off. Again, you'll be down to the two-can minimum or maximum purchase, you know. So people really shouldn't put that off. And as far as the expiration date, you always want to get the, you know, the furthest expiration date out from where you're buying it. You don't want to buy cans that are dented. You know, if you can only buy one can at a time, that's cool too, you know. But, you know, everybody's budget's not the same. You buy what you can afford. You don't buy, I would prefer not to buy from the dollar store because God only knows how long that's sat around in the hot sun, you know, or in a warehouse somewhere or whatever. And it just, you know, I want to shop at the main stores where they have, you know, where the product's being exchanged regularly. But anyway, but you don't want to buy cans that are dented because the liner that's on the inside of the can, that's what the warranty or the expiration date or best used by, that best used by date is all predicated on the liner. Because the can manufacturer says, no, we're not going to be responsible for your contents. So they'll say, you know, we're going to put a year on it, for example. You know, well, the food people, they're going to say, well, we don't want to go beyond that either. So, but the food typically, as long as the canned goods haven't been sitting in the hot sun, you know, as long as they're kept in a cool, dry place, that food will be good for years after that expiration date.
Correct.
And I, you know, I hate to say that and have people say, oh, I don't want to get sick. Well, you know, that's up to you. But if the crack hits the fan, I'd rather have that can of soup that's 2 years old. When I open it up, if it smells, I know it's no good. If it looks normal, it's probably going to taste normal. I'll take a sample. But generally speaking, you know, those would be good for years afterwards. And I bought some butter and cheese years ago. I need to find out where I put that. I bought that and had a 10-year warranty on it, 10-year shelf life. All right? I'm sure people have seen that, you know, where it says, oh, this cheese is good for 10 years. Well, I thought, well, you know what? You're not going to have cheese during a, you know, worst-case scenario. So I thought, cheese in a can, that sounds pretty good. And by golly, it tastes good, too. Same with butter in a can. Where are you going to get butter in a worst-case scenario? Because, you know, butter, it's nice to have some luxuries, and you need it right. For some, you know, for cooking some meals. But I bought the butter in a can, and it said, you know, 10-year shelf life. And I thought, okay, expiration date goes beyond that. So I contacted the manufacturer or the guy that the distributor, and then he's the one that gave me all this information. He said, you know what? He said, and he, you know, explained to me about the liner, and he's right. You know, I found other sources said the same thing. It's the liner on the inside of the can that usually most of your best used by dates are based on that liner, not on the contents or even the quality of the can. But don't buy dented cans because, again, that liner, that plastic coating on the inside could be torn with a dented can. So don't count on that, you know, in the end time.
Anyway. Oh, you're right.
Oh, right. Rice is another thing. Rice is something that can go long term. What I did, I buy like 20-pound bags of rice. Well, I don't like buying in, I've seen them in the cloth sacks and the woven sacks or whatever. I don't really like to have rice like that. It'll keep for a long time, but you can have bugs in there that'll eat it. Because I bought one bag of rice, you know, it was 10 or 20 pounds, and it was, you know, sealed in a nice plastic wrapper, right? Pretty solid. Well, I looked at it one day. We were getting ready to move, and there's a whole bunch of powder in there. That tells me that something's in there eating it. Now, granted, if it was a worst-case scenario, I wouldn't have tossed it out. But since it wasn't, you know, I tossed it. But with that in mind, the next time I'm going shopping for rice, I went, you know, I looked at the store. I looked at the most durable liner that they had, the most durable bag of rice. And there was one. It's almost like a Mylar bag. I mean, I don't think there's no way you could tear that with your hands. And I thought, you know what, that's a durable bag right there. I don't have to worry about it getting a pinhole in it or something where critters can get in there or smell it. And anyway, so I really advise people to buy rice, beans. You know, beans take a while to, you know, to get ready, but there's tips you can find on the internet to how to speed that up. Spices. You're going to need spices. You know, I guess there's a whole lot of stuff. You know, there's a lot in the book or whatever. In the back of the book, I give a lot of information on things that I feel that people should be putting away. You know, that's anything from Band-Aids to aspirin to, you know, when you go to thrift stores or garage sales, if you see a knee brace or an ankle brace or something like that, hey, you can pick that up for a buck. Why not get it? As long as you got room to store it, put that aside, because if the worst case scenario that you can imagine happens, they're not going to have medical attention. You're not going to be able to walk down to, you know, to the emergency room and get help, because I guarantee you there's going to be armed guards there, and there's going to be – they're not going to have time to take care of your broken foot or something like that. You're going to have to learn some of those basic medical deeds yourself. And having something that where you can immobilize a limb, that's a good thing. And if you can pick it up at a garage sale for a dollar, why not?
Now, chapter 23 in your book. And listeners, you're gonna love this chapter. It's called The Masked Planet. What you're going to see in chapter 23 is a how-to guide to making your own, what's the word I'm thinking of, quarantine room. And how to do it, and why, and who goes in there, and who doesn't. So that's important stuff. That's important information as far as I can see it. And I would also say that I like how you put the your sign off at the end of the book. Be prepared, be safe, and be healthy. Absolutely correct. If you don't have your health during a grid down situation, you, my friends, are in a lot of trouble. You don't even know it, but yeah, you'll be in a lot of trouble.
Amen. Right. And some of that right there, you know, if you've got special needs, special medical needs in your family, you know, whether it's an elderly person or a young child with asthma or whatever, you know, stuff like that, you really need to take into account when you're planning for your preps, because they're going to have certain needs. Like, you know, I've got a son-in-law who uses a CPAP mask. I don't see that happening. Because if the worst-case scenario happens, whether it's an EMP takes the grid out or terrorists take the grid out, or even if the grid just shuts down because there's a lack of fuel transporting across the country. Because you got to remember, when there's a pandemic, there's going to be quarantine issues where nothing's going to be able to come or go like it did back in the day, you know, back when things are normal. With that in mind, there might be slow for fuel deliveries to the power plant. But the power plant, you've got to have fuel coming constantly. You know what? I work at a power plant, and I know what kind of fuel they use, and it takes quite a bit. Same with water. You got to have cooling water. There's so many things that are needed for that, starting with the electricity that, you know, to get that plant started. Because, you know, if you took a plant that's dead in the water, no electricity, that plant can't start up by itself. It has to have a hydroelectric dam somewhere that can send power to it to get the motors started to get that power plant up.
Oh.
But, you know, with that in mind, you might not have electricity. So going back to the CPAP mask, something like that right there, if you have special needs, a ventilator or whatever, you need to consider that in your preps. You know, whether that – and my advice is if you can, if you've got a place where you're able to hold up or whatever, you know, until the things go back to normal, assuming they will, I really like solar power because it's quiet. It provides the electricity you need. You don't have to replenish it. If you have a generator, a lot of people have a generator and they think, well, I'm safe now because I got a generator. But you have to consider with a generator – if the worst-case scenario happens, if you've got a quiet neighborhood and you fire that generator up, you can hear that thing two or three blocks away, and I guarantee you people have time on their hands. They don't have TV or the Internet anymore. They're going to be coming to your house. If you're out there barbecuing your, you know, your chickens or the squirrel that you got out of the tree, whatever, that smell is going to waft through the neighborhood. You know, things like that, you're really going to consider too. You know, and that will bring hungry people real quick. Something that I considered, you know, people say, well, I don't like to cook inside the house. You know, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that you use charcoal grills in your house. But if you have a gas grill, that would be my advice. Bring it into the kitchen and cook there. That way there you're in a private environment. Nobody knows what you're doing. They say, yeah, but what about the fumes? It's like, we've got gas stoves in a million houses in America. I mean, it's the same thing. A gas stove or a propane stove, it's still the same thing. It's not going to burn up all your oxygen, you know. But
there you go.
Anyway, so again, with the, you know, another thing on the generator. And I know I'm bouncing all over. I apologize. But on the generator, another thing to consider, if you have a generator, you know, for example, if you've got a place out in the country and you've got a well and you want to fire that generator up to pump the well, you know, to get well water out, that's fine. Hopefully you have a big storage container. And I would just run it long enough to fill up that container, you know. But you got to consider the fuel that you're going to use, because gasoline doesn't store for very long. You can get stable, you know, and there's probably other products where it'll extend the life. But generally speaking, gasoline doesn't store very well. So my advice is, if you have access to a propane conversion kit, you know, or if you can buy a generator that works off propane, you put a tank of propane in the corner and you put a 5-gallon gas can, you can come back 20 years later or 100 years later, that propane, as long as the tank hasn't rusted, that propane's still ready to go. Gasoline, it's done in a couple of years. It's turned to jelly. You know, so
it does break something down quickly.
Yeah. I had a friend of mine gave me a small generator years ago, and it's a little 3.5 horsepower, 1,100-watt generator, but I found a conversion kit for it, you know, where I could run propane or gasoline. So that, you know, to me, that's my go-to move is, you know, just grab a propane tank and hook it up to that, and I'm good to go. But again, it won't run everything. Of course, it's not going to run your house, and it's doubtful that it would run the refrigerator for long enough to make it matter. But anyway, but like I said, if you're going to use a generator, consider the noise that it's going to make and consider the fuel source that you're going to have, because you just can't count on the gasoline.
All right. Good information. Good advice. All right, buddy. Let's we're running a little. Yeah. Tell you what. Let's wrap this up. I would like to have you back on sometime. Would you like to do this?
I would be happy to. Thank you.
I think it'd be a good time. And I will tell you what. Don't hang up when we're done with the interview here. Don't hang up. I'll want to chat with you briefly. If you want to get a hold of Kenny, how can they get, if my listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they get a hold of you?
I've got a website on Facebook called the Pandemic Preparedness Guide. I actually set it up for the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes it gets political, and I apologize for that. I wish all these politics were done, because I've avoided Facebook for years because it's so time consuming. But I thought, you know what, the only way to really get this book out there and let people know what's in it and just offer other ideas and share other ideas. So they can go to the Pandemic Preparedness Guide on Facebook, and there they'll find me, or if they want to email me or contact me, my information should be there. And same with a link to the book if they want to, you know, get it. And whether they get my book or somebody else's, education is paramount. You've got to be educated. And while my book is called the Pandemic Preparedness Guide, like many prepper books, it's more than just about pandemics, because if the doo-doo hits the fan for whatever reason, you know, whether it's a hurricane comes through, you know, like they had in Homestead years ago, the tips that are in there as far as defending yourself or protecting yourself, things that you need to have set aside, you know, there's just so much good information in there that really isn't specific to a pandemic. And I hope people realize that, you know, that just, you got to be informed. You really have to be educated to survive anything that's coming. And with 300,000 Trojan horse refugees coming, who knows what to do. And in fact, one of the things, you know what? I had a couple more things I want to make real quick.
Go ahead.
Okay. As far as, you know, the refugees go, what people may not know about is ISIS. You know, everybody knows who ISIS is by now. ISIS, and I saw this, and I've seen it, you know, the news refuted. They said, oh, no, this isn't true. But I've seen it in too many other places where they said that it is true, that ISIS is over in Mexico right now. They've got to continue to care that the drug cartels are working with them, and they're right on our border. So with that in mind, their goal, according to the chatter by some federal sources, said that their goal is to take out our electric grid. So please don't put off getting ready. And I also want to say one more thing about Ebola. You know, the Ebola virus, as far as we know, that disappeared last year. All right. Oh, actually, in the late 2014 was the last we heard of it. And it pretty much did, you know, the Ebola thing's done. So nobody talks about it or worries about it anymore. But here, one year after it supposedly went away, I came across an article. The state of Virginia was actively searching for a state Ebola coordinator. Now, why would you need that for a virus that's gone away? Then I found another thing. The state of Idaho was also looking for a state Ebola coordinator. Then I came across a hospital in Wyoming. They're looking for state or for Ebola people that are experienced with Ebola. And I came across article after article where companies or hospitals and even states are looking for people to work with Ebola. I'm thinking, well, what in the world do you need that for a virus that's gone away? So I don't think we've seen the last of Ebola. So keep your head on that swivel, Alan.
Ebola always comes back.
Yep. And it's
Didn't they have a terrible Ebola outbreak in Zaire 1976?
Yes. Well, it was actually started, I believe it was discovered initially back in 1947, I think. I'll have to do my research on that one.
But you know what?
No,
you're right. Because for all we know, Ebola could have been around for centuries before. We just didn't have the technology or the know-how to isolate and actually realize this is a virus. It's been coming back. It comes back every so often. So, yeah.
Just like the Zika virus that you know that everybody's concerned with right now. That was way back in 1947 that they encountered that. But, you know, it's been a pretty mild thing, so nobody really worried about it. It wasn't until the recent stuff where children started having the microcephaly that they started getting concerned about it. And, in fact, you know, people have been paying attention to the news. Just this week or last week, the Senate voted to allocate or re-divert $1.1 billion from the Ebola fund, you know, that was set up to help fight Ebola. They diverted $1.1 billion to fight Zika, which is kind of curious because Zika hasn't killed anybody in the United States yet. In fact, nobody's been infected with the Zika virus in the United States yet, except for people that returned, you know, they were diagnosed with it. They returned from traveling to regions where Zika virus was a problem. That doesn't mean it's not ever going to come here, because it probably will. But, you know, again, it's not a deadly virus. The most dangerous thing the Zika virus is to anybody is to pregnant mothers. And as long as they wear plenty of DEET, and I checked on that this morning, DEET up to 30% concentration is safe for pregnant women, according to the CDC, pregnant and nursing women and their babies.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And the Zika virus, in case people don't know, again, it's only affecting pregnant mothers, you know, and not even really affecting them as much as it is. It's affecting their developing child. And
right.
What it is, you know, when the baby's born, they have microcephalic. Their brain didn't develop properly, and you'll notice that their head shrunk, you know, and
right.
And because the brain didn't develop. But again, that's something that if people are concerned about the Zika virus, and again, they should be if they're pregnant or if they got somebody, you know, in their group or whatever that's pregnant, their family members or whatever, they should make sure that the person wears as much covering as possible when they're outside during peak time when mosquitoes are flying around. They should clear out all the places on their property, you know, like tires or buckets or pans or whatever that can contain water, because the mosquitoes, they'll put their larvae in all the standing bodies of water. And I mean, we see it here in Florida all the time, and the mosquitoes just breed like crazy. So you got to make sure that, you know, places where water can stand. And other than that, you know, wear a insect repellent with DEET. DEET is the best product out there right now. And again, you know, up to 30% concentration for pregnant women is safe.
There you go. That's important. DEET. That's
right.
Been around for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. All right, my friend. I think we've got a really good start on this interview. I'm glad you're a friend of the Contra Radio Network. Again, the name of Ken's book is The Pandemic Preparedness Guide by Kenneth McClelland. You can get it at Amazon or any place that books are sold. Get the real book for your library. It's that important, guys. It's that important. And we're going to have Kenneth back on just because I enjoy talking with him. So anything else you'd like to say to the listeners, Ken, before we call it quits?
No, just be safe. Be safe and keep your ears open, because a lot of these things that are going on, I don't think that people are paying attention to it. You know,
they
like
aren't.
We were talking about flu. There was three different strains of bird flu that took 50 million turkeys and chickens off of our plates. You know,
real
but
fast.
A lot of people aren't aware of that. Same with the Ebola thing. You know, most people don't know about these state coordinators being hired. You know, there's just so much stuff going on with the viruses right now that it's important. It's important to start getting prepared for such an event. And again, you know, prepping for any event is important because we don't know what's coming. It could come in a form that we're not even – that's what I learned from Doomsday Preppers. You listen to some of the people that are getting prepared on Doomsday Preppers, and it's like this person's concerned about hurricanes, this one about floods, this one about lightning bolts or aliens or – everybody preps – well, not everybody, but, you know, people can prep for any number of reasons. But the important thing is that they get prepped. You know, you don't have to take it overboard. You don't have to, you know, put a bubble around your children or anything. But if you don't prep now, when something does happen, it's too late. It's too late. Right. You're one of those people going on your neighbor's door saying, hey, can you spare some chili for my family? And that's when somebody's going to get hurt because either the person that puts stuff away is going to be defensive, which you can understand. You know, because when I'm stocking food away, I'm not preparing to feed my neighbors, you know, or even, you know, some of my family members. You know, I got, right. You know, Cousin Louie shows up at my door with his three kids and his dog. It's like, hey, sorry, Cousin Louie, I don't have room for you, you know. Well, he's going to bring a shotgun. You know what I mean? It's not going to be pretty.
No, you're right. We got people who'd rather sit there and drive a new car every year. And we got people who just got to have that big house, have to have that big screen TV, they have to have the newest, latest, and greatest, yet they don't even take the time to have the responsibility to prep, put some stuff aside for an emergency situation. They won't do it. You're right. You're absolutely right.
And it's sad because for everybody out there that's, like you said, you know, they're putting all their time and effort, they get free time, they're out golfing or fishing or something, and that's fine. It's nice to have fun, but take some of that money instead of the new golf clubs. Put some food away because you've got people depending on you. You know, you might think, well, I'm not going to get mixed up in that prepper stuff. I don't want to be known as a prepper. But what about your husband or your wife or your children or your grandpa, whoever? You know, what about them? They're putting their trust in you because you're the head of the family. If you're not preparing, you're putting their lives at risk more than your own. And then, again, that person will be knocking on someone else's door saying, hey, can you spare some chili? And they will be willing to kill you for that chili because now their family depends on them and they see how dire their straits are. So it's not going to be pretty.
There's truth to it, people. Truth to it.
Yeah, I think we all wish we had some island we could go to, but it's not realistic.
That's true.
One thing, you'll never prepare for everything. No matter, you can try, but you'll never prepare for everything. You know, for the preppers out there, they're just getting started. There's a whirlwind of information on the internet, on Facebook, you know, on your site and mine and a thousand others, where people can get the basics of how to start preparing. And start off with, you know, the dollar menu or the buy one, get one free when you walk into your supermarket. Take advantage of that. Garage sales. I found a solar panel at a garage sale. Well, when I was in Colorado, I found one, and they only wanted $15 for it. I couldn't get it on the airplane, so I had to pass it up. But stuff like that, it's at the garage sales, you know. And if you're just starting out, if you got say, two families, you know, brother and his wife and, you know, and their family or whatever, you get together and you say, all right, let's make it like a scavenger hunt. You go to garage sales and you say, all right, well, let me see. We need lanterns or we need oil for the, you know, oil lamps, or we need a small generator or solar panels. You look for that stuff at garage sales and thrift stores, and you make it fun into a scavenger hunt type situation. It doesn't cost a lot of money, and you can get prepped, you know, as a group. It's just there's no reason why anybody shouldn't be able to get prepped that wants to get prepped.
There you go. That's Kenneth McClellan, the author of the book, The Pandemic Preparedness Guide, Biohazards. I suggest you get it. Okay, Kenny, thanks for joining us. I want to have you on again, because we're running out of time right now. But anyways, you bring up some really good points. I'm glad to have you on here, and I enjoyed our interview. Stick around, and after we're done doing this segment, and we'll take care of some business then. All right, this is John Jeffers telling my prepper and patriot friends, be safe, be alert, and be vigilant. We'll see you on Wednesday night, which will be our canning episode. I know a lot of you have been asking about it. We're going to talk about canning and how to do it. All right. This is John Jeffers. Have a good night, and thanks for joining us.
Welcome to Total Wine and More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.
Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy. They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine & More.